This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. No one living has ever seen anything quite like what's happening to our economy now. Tens of millions of Americans have filed for unemployment in just a matter of weeks. Millions more can't even get through the systems to file. We don't know how many workers have been furloughed or had their hours cut. And there's already concern that the multi-trillion dollar relief package won't be enough to tide us over to the other side of this pandemic, whenever that comes. The pain is just enormous. And the brunt of it is being borne by those who didn't have much of a cushion to begin with. To make sense of where things are headed, last week I called up John Cassidy, who covers economics and politics for The New Yorker. John, we're hearing so many dire statistics about the economy. Before we dive into them, how would you differentiate between the Great Depression and the way that began and the way it stuck around for years and what we seem to be entering here during this coronavirus economic crisis?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, they are very different. They're similar in that they're huge, they're just huge downturns. But the Great Depression, the stock market crash was in October 1929, and unemployment didn't peak until 1933 at about 25%. So it was a gradual process, whereas what we've seen here is just a sudden stop to the economy. So it's more like a heart attack than the Great Depression. We've just said, bang, stop, not everything, but a lot of things. And we've imposed these enormous restrictions on the economy, but on the other side, these equally enormous rescue programs to try and keep businesses and households on life support until we allow the economy to come back again. What we're starting to find in the last couple of weeks is that these life support programs, even though they are very large, they're not reaching everybody. And a lot of people are being laid off. We knew that would happen, but a lot of the people who are being laid off aren't getting access to their unemployment claims, and a lot of firms aren't getting access to the programs that they're entitled to.
Now, you say that we turned the economy off artificially, obviously for public health reasons. At some point, whether gradually or quickly, a lot of those restrictions will be reversed. And we hope it's soon, and we hope it's done in the healthiest way possible. Why wouldn't the economy then swing back upward the way the president claims daily?
Well, there certainly will be some comeback. I don't think anybody thinks that reopening parts of the economy won't have any impact. I mean, just arithmetically, obviously, businesses which are closed, if they open, factories start operating again. But the problem is that all the indications are it won't come back as strongly as it is before for a few reasons. The main one being that most people, or a lot of people, are still very reluctant to go out until we get a full handle or on the virus, testing, or better still, some sort of vaccine or therapeutic. You can look around the world. I mean, we're basically a month or two behind Asia, and the Asian countries did start reopening their economy about a month or 6 weeks ago. And what you see there is definitely a bounce back, but it's nowhere near as strong as it was before. I was looking, for example, at the casinos in Macau. They're only running at 20% of the previous revenues, you know, which suggests that 80% of the customers are still staying away. I'm not saying that's going to be replicated everywhere in the US. I think things will obviously come back stronger than 20%, but it just gives an indication of the challenges we see ahead.
At the start of the pandemic, the first people to lose their jobs were in jobs like restaurants and airlines and hotels. Where's the next wave of job losses likely to be concentrated?
Well, this is what the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department of policymakers are trying to avoid. As you said, basically the frontline industries get closed down first. But what you often get in a severe economic downturn, as some industries turn down, people lose income, people are thrown out of work, people start to give up on bank loans, etc. You get a spiraling downwards. And the second wave of unemployment basically is economy-wide, just because all businesses see a dropping demand. So you're starting to see that now in industries like media, for example, where advertising has collapsed. So media companies are starting to lay people off. You see it in secondary industries which depend on travel. For example, the airline manufacturing industry, General Electric, which makes aircraft engines. Boeing is not building as many planes as it used to do, so General Electric can't sell as many engines. It feeds down through the supply chain, and you're going to see that in industry after industry if this goes on for a few months.
So far, 26.5 million people have filed for unemployment, and there's indications that by the time we go on the air in a few days, there will be even more people filing, many more millions. Just how high could the unemployment rate climb?
Well, there are various estimates. I mean, most people think that we're up to about 30 million now, given this week's claims. And most people think it'd go considerably higher from there. In terms of unemployment rates, there have been estimates as high as 30%. I think the consensus on Wall Street is about 20, 25%. We'll get a figure a week on Friday, on May the 8th, for April. And it's likely to be the highest rate since, well, some people think it might be the highest rate since the recession of the 1980s. Some people think it might be even go back to the 30s.
You've seen a lot of frontline workers at places like Amazon, Walmart, FedEx, upset over their pay and their personal safety. Do you think this crisis is going to have an effect on the labor movement, which has been, compared to decades in the past, relatively weak? And do you think there'll be a bigger push for $15 minimum wage and other benefits?
Yes, I think it depends how long it lasts. It's certainly give it a push at the moment. You're already seeing more sort of union organization, more activism, as you say, in the meat processing plants where conditions were terrible and more than 20 workers have already died because they have to stand so close to each other and the virus was spreading. You see quite effective activism there, although Trump has now undermined it by imposing a sort of federal emergency order. But anyway, to answer the broader question about whether there's going to be a bigger rebound, Amazon is a test case, of course, because they've always resisted unionization and a very aggressive management style. There was a protest in Staten Island a few weeks ago about the sort of health and safety and the reaction to the coronavirus, and they fired the people who organized it. They do that all over the country. So I think Amazon could be the test case, and if they were to be forced to accept unionization, that would be a huge victory for the labor movement. I mean, I've written about this, lots of people have written about it. Extended crises, wars, pandemics, etc., if they go on a long time, do tend to produce big political changes and big social changes, and often in a progressive direction, because it becomes obvious in crises, in wars and in pandemics, the contribution made by ordinary people and working people. We see that the economy can't work if there's nobody producing meat. The economy can't work if there's nobody delivering packages.
Well, how is it unique in this country? In other words, what has the pandemic revealed economically in the United States as opposed to other places, comparatively?
Well, the United States is a more unequal country and has been historically than most other Western democracies. And what the pandemic has done in various ways is just illuminating these underlying inequities and inequalities that have been there a long time. So all those things are coming together. And I think if the crisis was to go on for years, that would definitely feed through into sort of progressive programs and a wave of populism, big legislation, big changes, as we saw during the Great Depression and we see after the Second World War. But if it's only a few months and if it bounced back, I think it's much more difficult to sustain that sort of movement and that pressure for change. So a lot depends on how the pandemic plays out, basically, I think.
Well, what is the best possible scenario here? The worst possible scenarios we've gone through in pretty grim detail. What is the best that can happen economically here?
Well, I think the best scenario we can have is a sort of gradual, reasonably strong bounce back. Even Trump himself has now stopped talking about a bounce back in the summer, and he's saying that things will bounce back in the third quarter, which begins in September. That may be reasonable. So if we can get mass testing working Fauci said the other day that it'll be working by the end of May, but I think that's probably too optimistic. But if we can get it up and running at least by the summer, the idea is that by the fall, when colleges and schools, if they start going back, that'll be obviously be a big change. If the factories are mostly reopened, restaurants and other businesses are reopened using social distancing, and the idea that the Fed's programs have worked, we won't have had a full-on financial collapse, and things will be heading in the right direction. I think that's the best reasonable scenario, and we get a reasonably strong but gradual recovery.
And do you think the odds are halfway decent for that?
Well, I think they're better than they were, just because the federal response, it can't be as bad as it was in the beginning, because it was non-existent in the beginning. I think businesses and states are gradually realized they had to work around the federal government. Like the New York being a good example, is starting to introduce mass testing, serology tests, etc. But also on the business side, they're starting to respond because they realize the government won't do it for them. So Amazon, for example, has said it's now working on a program to test all its employees. JetBlue announcing that you have to wear a mask to get on a plane. So I think things are gradually moving in the right direction on the sort of testing and mask policy. But it would have been so much easier if we had proper leadership from the top, because it's all a matter of coordination, and that central coordination has just been sorely lacking, obviously.
John Cassidy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Cassidy is a staff writer specializing in politics and economics. You can read all of his work at newyorker.com and subscribe to his newsletter. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hi, it's David Remnick. As the 2024 election draws near, it's more important than ever to understand exactly what's happening in American politics. The New Yorker offers definitive reporting and analysis by some of the best writers and political thinkers watching the campaign. Commentators and reporters, including Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, Jelani Cobb, Masha Gessen, Evan Osnos, Ben Wallace Wells, and many more are providing incisive analysis that you don't want to miss. Subscribers get unlimited access to all of it. And we're offering a deal just for podcast listeners, 15% off a yearly digital subscription. Visit newyorker.com and use the code POD15. That's POD15 for 15% off a digital subscription to The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm joined now by Kai Wright, the host of the program, The United States of Anxiety from WNYC. Kai, welcome back. It's great to see you over Zoom, at least.
Exactly. This is the closest we can get.
It was just 3 months ago, which now feels like 5 years ago, that you joined me for an episode that we devoted to the issue of mass incarceration and the consequences of that policy. Now we're watching as the coronavirus wreaks havoc on every facet of our lives, including inside our nation's prisons and jails. So, Kai, what does it mean for people who are behind bars still and people working in prisons as well?
It means really quite acute danger, honestly. I saw a list this morning. There was something about like 150 people that have died that at least have been documented so far inside jails and prisons. The number is certainly growing. It's impossible to social distance in those environments.
Now, some authorities and in some areas around the country have sent some people home or sent people out of prison to achieve just what you're describing, some more social distance there, maybe not people who are convicted of the most violent crimes. Is that not a step forward? Has it not achieved anything?
Well, it has, but keep in mind, I mean, so there are about 2.3 million people incarcerated in the United States. That's a huge spectrum of folks, ranging from people who are waiting for trial, who can't make bail, who, you know, are there on minor drug charges, on up through violent offenders, right? When you think about that number, the most recent number I've seen of who's been released comes from the UCLA Law School, who's been tracking this, and they calculate there's about 38,000 people who've been released from the system. So out of that 2.3 million, that's less than 2%, and it's hard to see how that's going to make any real difference in terms of the ability to social distance or to reduce the transmission of the virus inside these facilities.
You recently talked with someone at the American Civil Liberties Union who knows about these issues. Who is that?
Udi Ofer is a head of the ACLU's Justice Division. So that means he heads up their criminal justice reform efforts overall. And he's been kind of spearheading the organization's effort to go literally county by county, state by state, and to the federal government and try to urge them to stop arresting so many people. And two, governors, use all the power that you have to let as many people out as you can, particularly the people who we know to be most vulnerable.
We're in a real crisis situation in jails and prisons, and even more so than the crisis we're all facing across the nation. About 40% of people in prison before COVID-19 have at least one chronic health condition, such as asthma or diabetes, right? HIV is 4 to 5 times higher among people in prison than in the general population. People in our nation's prisons are older. So the communities that the CDC has told us are most vulnerable to COVID-19 are exactly the communities that are housed in our nation's jails and prisons.
So you guys have reached out to 25 states, right? 25 governors, if I'm correct. What is it you were requesting, and who's sort of been taking the most effective action so far?
Yeah, we're asking governors to tell their prosecutors, their police, their sheriffs, to stop bringing people into the system in the first place. Stop making custodial arrests for low-level offenses. If you have to make an arrest, give someone a ticket instead of taking them to central booking. That may sound like not a big deal, but right now it literally is a life and death situation.
And are there places that you see that are doing that, that are taking this up? Who's doing a good job?
Yeah, so look, I want to be careful here because I think everyone needs to do a lot more, but I also want to give credit where credit is due. So look, in Colorado, for example, Governor Polis has issued a couple of executive orders. We have seen about a 40% reduction in the state's jail population. And, you know, and sheriffs there and police officers are starting to, you know, get people, making sure the jail population is going down. In Wisconsin, we saw the secretary there begin releasing people on what's known as supervision holds. In Kentucky, we've seen a bipartisan coalition lead to an executive order that has led to about 800 fewer people in prison and the county jails had been reduced by about 28%. Washington State Governor Inslee issued an executive order that got about 950 people out. New Jersey has been in the forefront in many ways, both through the Supreme Court and Governor Murphy issuing an executive order. So we are seeing examples we could point to. And I'm proud to say that some of these are even in Republican administrations, which I think is a very powerful statement. But we need.
Well, I was trying to track that math as you were speaking. I was trying to say, okay, which ones of these are Democrats or Republicans? So I would assume that it would be largely Democrats, but you are seeing Republicans who are stepping forward with this too.
Yeah, in Kentucky, the ACLU is working with Republican allies to get people out of prisons and jails. So, look, I mean, the way I always talk about the movement to end mass incarceration is that in many ways, it's an island of political agreement in a sea of bickering, right? We've actually seen a lot of successes over the past couple of years in red states and blue states to begin tackling mass incarceration. But everything has become a lot more urgent now during this COVID-19 crisis.
I wonder how this changes that in the long term, in terms of either making it more or less likely that movement will continue. I've thought about that. What do you think?
Yeah, look, I don't want to find I'm trying to be careful and not find anything positive about this horrible pandemic we're all living through, because there's nothing good about it. At the same time, some mornings I wake up feeling a bit more hopeful where, look, we've always struggled to make the public and politicians realize that people who are living in jails and prisons are our families, are our neighbors, are human beings. And seeing the fact that more than 16,000 people have been released from prisons and jails by ACLU count since the pandemic began, and that the public is being supportive of this, gives me that ray of hope that maybe this is the tipping point that we've all been waiting for in the mass incarceration space.
And what about violent offenders? I mean, this is always the third rail of this conversation. I imagine those are the folks who are not being released at this time. What's going to happen there?
Yeah, it is true that in the vast majority of releases, it's mostly people who are held for drug or property offenses, or what are called nonviolent offenses. And that's unfortunate, particularly when you're talking about prisons, right? Look, one of the phenomenons of mass incarceration is that we have seen a 300% spike over the past 20 years of the number of people age 55 or older who are in prison. So the reason people are held for these long sentences a lot of times are because they were incarcerated for violent offenses that they engaged in when they were in their teens or in their 20s. Yet here we are 20, 30 years later, and they're still being incarcerated for these mistakes. So I'm hoping that in the coming weeks, we're going to see an increase of the number of elderly people who are being released, including people who were incarcerated for offenses involving violence. And to any listeners out there who are worried about what does that mean for crime in America, the recidivism rate for elderly people is at the single digits, if not lower. People age out of crime. That is a fact that has been documented through many studies. It makes no public safety sense to hold someone when they're in their 50s, 60s or older, if the reason is public safety.
What about like correction staff and law enforcement unions? These are some of the folks who have traditionally been opposed to decarceration campaigns. And this outbreak is, I would imagine, not great news for prison guards either. So how have they responded to this moment and this effort?
Yeah. So this is going to be a bit of a weird answer, but so far they haven't been vocal as they would otherwise about all of the releases that are happening. So in many ways, their non-response, I think, speaks volumes. Everyone's life is at risk. There are more than 37,000 federal corrections employees, and I know that they're frustrated with the Trump administration's lack of an appropriate response. And I think we're going to start hearing more from federal correctional unions and from other spaces demanding more from the Trump administration.
I wonder if it will have any impact on how the decarceration movement operates out of this, if there's something new that will come out of it.
I can't answer that fully now, but one of the things that I'm noticing on my team, and this is, you know, it's a bit of an admission, right? We normally do not talk about the health of corrections officers. We're focused on people who are incarcerated in jails and prisons. We at the ACLU, we're about to release what we're calling a memorial for people who have died because of COVID-19 in prisons and jails. The first version of that was only going to include incarcerated people. But then as we were kind of talking about it, we were like, you know what? We have to include corrections officers. You know, they're dying. They're risking their families. So we're going to add that. And I don't think we would have done that before COVID-19. So maybe we, even as the decarcerators, are developing more empathy for the people who not only live inside prisons and jails, but also work inside prisons and jails.
That's Udi Ofer of the American Civil Liberties Union talking with Kai Wright, the host of WNYC's The United States of Anxiety. And they spoke in April. We should note that some of the numbers they mentioned may have already changed. Udi Ofer singled out a number of states that are trying to reduce their prison populations in response to the coronavirus. New Jersey is among them. The state has the second highest rate of infections in the country. County jails have temporarily released more than 800 people, and New Jersey's Governor Phil Murphy signed an executive order to begin releasing certain at-risk inmates in the state prison system. I spoke with Governor Murphy about a week ago.
Yeah, how are you holding up?
I'm holding up. I mean, we're going to, you know, today is going to be another day with several hundred more fatalities we're going to announce in a couple of hours. And, you know, we think we're in a meaningfully better place than we may have been a week to two ago, but we're not out of the woods without any question.
Certainly not. Governor, I know you've been inundated with information and so many challenges related to coronavirus for months now, but I have to ask, when did you first become aware that prisons were going to become a major hotspot for transmission and that the prison population was at particular risk?
Early on. I can't give you a specific date, but we knew that we're not going to crack the back of this virus if we only bring some of us along. We got to bring everybody along.
What is the prison population, and how many people are you planning to let out?
The population at the state level, I believe, is about 19,000, and that's down over time from 30,000 not that long ago. I don't have a county jail number specifically for you, but obviously there's a different jurisdiction there. And the number in terms of the folks who will be let out is yet to be determined. And so we're right now going through batches of populations, and the batches are defined by things like age, underlying conditions. Another one is within X days of maxing out a sentence. Another batch is folks within a certain amount of time to parole. Yet another batch is folks who had been up for parole within the past year and had been denied for whatever reason. So we're going through that process batch by batch. And as you can imagine, you want to get that right. Not just the right people are being released, but that there's something for them to be released to, just to make sure that folks have a place to go, a home, some sort of a safety net, that we're not just throwing people out in the streets. And we got to be very careful in terms of those decisions.
How do you respond to the critics who have said that this process in New Jersey hasn't moved fast enough and that these people point to other states which have released many more inmates? How do you respond to that?
I've got to do this responsibly is my answer, and we take this very seriously. You know, we are, if you look at steps taken by states in America, and again, this is a general comment, but it does include corrections. I don't know that any state, when you add up all the steps we've taken in America, has been more aggressive. But we've also made sure that we've done it as right as we can. I'll give you an example. When we closed schools, we made each district come up with their emergency action plan. And unless we blessed it, we did not allow them to shut down. Reasons, mostly because of lack of access for too many of our kids to a device. You had to have an explicit paper plan for remote learning. Another reason was access to a hot meal, where for schools it might have been their only opportunity of the day for too many kids in our state to get a reliable meal. So we took an extra couple of days to make sure we got that right. And I want to make sure we get any major shift in our population in our corrections community also as right as we can.
Well, how have you responded to police and corrections officers unions that have opposed releases and other reforms? Have they come to you with their concerns and tried to block anything?
I have not gotten incomings personally. It's not to say that my team has not. They also are worried about their own populations. You know, you look at the corrections officers, we've lost some. Healthcare workers who work in corrections facilities, we've lost some. You know, they're focused not just on what we're doing with the prison population, they're focused on their own ranks, as they should be, and understandably.
Governor, give me the political dynamics of dealing with the prison population in particular. There are people on one end of the political spectrum saying you can't let anybody out. And then there have been voices, particularly on the left, who say, well, in this situation, this incredibly horrific emergency situation, all prisoners should be let out because of the circumstances of prisons themselves, which are where everybody's up against each other and things can spread like wildfire.
So I'd say a couple of things. Number one, there's no scenario where we can let all prisoners out. I mean, I've got to draw the line between violent and nonviolent. And that's a line that we'll adhere to. For the folks, even in the violent offender category, I hope sooner than later we'll be able to achieve the social distancing and the sort of basics that may be more difficult or may have been more difficult without any of these releases. And secondly, I haven't really spent any time on the politics. In all the steps we've taken, we're trying to make the call as best we can based on the facts, based on the data, based on the science.
But are you, you have to say to yourself in the position that you're in uniquely, I'm willing to put certain people at much higher risk, that is leave them in prison because of their past record. Is that what you're saying? That that violent offenders, they're going to just be at higher risk because I can't let them out.
I think you can say both of those things, that, you know what, I'm sorry, but the violent offenders are going to have to stay in the system, but we're going to be able to much more appropriately and proactively care for their well-being while they're in the system.
Governor Murphy, I wish you the best, and thank you so much.
Thanks for being on, David.
Phil Murphy, governor of New Jersey. We spoke about a week ago. I'm joined today by Kai Wright, who's the host of WNYC's program, The United States of Anxiety. So, Kai, for those who are being released, what happens to them after they get out of prison? They're re-entering society at an incredibly stressful, complicated moment.
Yeah, it's hard to say, quite honestly. I mean, for a number of people, they're being released into home detention, right? So they're being sent with either with ankle bracelets or back into their homes to quarantine with their families. It raises an enormous number of questions. I mean, one of the things that we have to remember is that part of what's happened in mass incarceration is we have turned prisons into the one place where people get a number of social services that they need, from alcohol and drug treatment to mental health treatment, in many cases to forms of healthcare. And so there are a number of things that have to be done in folks' lives because of the way we've organized society. And I think it's going to be jurisdiction by jurisdiction a challenge to figure out how to do this. I think the hopeful note is that if they do that, if we're able to figure out how to do reentry correctly in the course of this in those places, it may make that a much easier process when this is over as well.
Well, I was going to ask, do you think that this terrible experience, which is affecting so much of society in so many ways, might have some kind of influence on the criminal justice system when we are past COVID-19?
I think it depends on what you mean. So I think in the sense of that there will be counties and states in particular who will have made the political and economic investment in decarceration of some sort. And I think that you will see a permanent downtick in some of those places in terms of the number of people who are held in these facilities. But on a broader level, in terms of changing our faith, which is really the only way you can describe it, our faith in the idea that punishment and incarceration is the way to deal with social ills, I don't see how this changes that in any way. I mean, that's rooted in 150 years worth of racist ideas about the ways in which Black and brown people are a threat to society. And this crisis won't upend that. The only thing that would upend that is a change in political power. And indeed, I'm probably most concerned about the ways in which this crisis will decrease the political power of the communities that are most affected by mass incarceration.
Why do you say that?
Well, because we are in the middle of an election year, the people who are most affected by this are the people who are most easily disenfranchised. And I think one of the problems that we are going to be staring down as this crisis unfolds is how does democracy continue to function?
Kai, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kai Wright hosts the United States of Anxiety from WNYC. Now, we've been covering this issue for quite a while, and we're going to keep following it as prisons respond to the pandemic. Some weeks from now, you'll hear what it's like for an inmate being released into a world that's been transformed by the crisis. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Gofen Mputubwele is a producer for the program, and a little while back, he pitched me on interviewing a rapper named Chica. And he seemed so enthusiastic about having her on the show that I just said, why don't you do the interview? So, Gofen, why were you so excited about interviewing Chica? What is it about her that you're so enthusiastic about?
So my family is Congolese from the Congo, and one of the experiences that a lot of us have as first generation Americans whose parents are immigrants from Africa is that we don't see a lot of ourselves ever in the media, in films, in any big stream area, major stream area. And so seeing this rapper who was first gen African at a major label, Warner Records, is really exciting. And I was really curious to find out more about her music.
And her family, where do they come from?
So she's from Alabama. Her family is from Nigeria. And she's really young, too. She is 23.
And how did she come to your attention?
So Chica in 2016 became viral off of a kind of satiric comedic video that she posted the night of the election. And since then, she's had a series of videos, one major one being a response to Kanye West's kind of politics in the Trump era that went immensely viral. And so she continues to have this kind of presence tied with commenting on what's going on in society.
Yeah. Now, Mr. West, take a seat. I implore you. Over time, it seems it's gotten harder to ignore you. You undo the progress of the geniuses before you. King gave you the box, and now we know you can afford her. It don't matter how much money you got or you lack. When that check cleared, don't forget.
Someone had liked one of your tweets. That's how I like saw you on the internet. And I was like, oh, you know, I started following you. And then at some point, I was like, Oh, she's Nigerian? Yes, we have another like first gen person out here.
We're literally a gang.
You know, because there's like, oh my gosh, the way that I've been describing the immigrant, first gen African immigrant experience recently is like, there's like before Black Panther and then there's after Black Panther.
Mm-hmm. We can press like, the issue because it is different. But, it is different out here.
Yeah. There was nothing, I don't know, in my experience, there was nothing that was cool or like desirable or whatever. Redeemable. About,
like, oh my God. And now everybody's Wakanda forever. Yeah. I can't. I just cannot.
What was telling your parents, like, I want to be a rapper? What was that experience like?
For some reason, that's one of the smoothest exits from a college that an African child probably has ever seen, because I planned it. I literally, I knew that I could not go empty handed into that conversation. And so I literally was like, how do I tell these people that I am done? And so in the months leading up to school, like that semester ending, I was like, how do I do this? And I went home right before, like probably a month or two before school ended. And I was like, hey, y'all, how y'all been? Sat them down and was like, all right, but like, look at this real quick. College is applied time. And if I apply my time elsewhere in the field that I want to work in, is that not the same as going to college? Like, I am wasting my prime years in a place where I don't even know what I'm doing because I didn't have a declared major. And I was like, I'm wasting money, I'm wasting time. And on top of that, like, doing music as a hobby, yeah, you can do that in your spare time, but what spare time will I have when I'm in college? Like, this makes no sense. I know what career path I want to go into.
What was the look on your parents' faces when you were like launching into like your prepared speech about why you wanted to leave college?
It was like just the most skeptical and also we're tired of you faces. Like, my dad is he's a skeptic, but he's like the laid back skeptic. My mom, though, she's like, nah. And I was like, so look, give me a year to make some shake. And I will go back to school after a year if nothing pops off. And they agreed. They told me I had to get a job. They're like, yeah, you can chill here, you can stay at the crib. And I was like, hey, it's lit. And then I left school June 2016 and I popped off in November.
So I want to talk about one of my favorite songs on the album, Songs About You.
Love it.
So the line goes, I met Hove last week. That was hella cool. Diddy introduced me as best of the new school.
I met Hove last week. That was hella cool. Diddy introduced me as best of the new school. Not too shabby for an Alabama bitch for getting rich. I got respect from heavy hitters and did it without a disc. And I came to deliver. I'm off of Twitter. And in your speakers, we gonna see.
Tell me about when you met them. And what was that like?
It wasn't awkward, but for me, it felt awkward just because I was at the Rock Nation brunch.
The Rock Nation brunch being one of the biggest music events of the year, Rock Nation, Jay-Z's label. So you're just hanging out like one does.
You know, just chilling in Beyonce and Jay-Z's space, just, you know, in there. But my manager was working at Rock at the time, and she somehow, with all her grace and wisdom, had finessed me into there. And I had gone. I didn't know I was going until I think either one or two days before. So I had no time to prepare. I wasn't in like a fancy outfit. Like, I wore a sweater and some boots and like was chilling. Like, I was from Alabama and it was so obvious. But I was extremely nervous to be there. Like, I was like, I can't do this. Like, I think I walked in and the first person I saw was like Fat Joe and DJ Khaled just chilling. And so we had just gotten there. We had like a drink, and we're standing out there because we all enter through the same door. Like, there's pictures, and you know, you get your glass of champagne and go into the event. But as soon as I walk out there, just as the universe would have it, the two people entering, it is literally Jay-Z and Diddy at the door, and I'm like, this is a joke. This is actually a joke. I don't know who planned this, but I'm being punked. And so I am like burying my face on my phone, and all of a sudden Diddy goes, yo, and like, I'm like, oh my God, here we go. Leave it to this one man to just blow my cover completely. And I'm like, yo. And he goes, Hove. And Jay-Z, like I say always, he spins on his heel and looks at Diddy like, what? Like, what's up? He's like, do you know who this is? And I'm like, don't say that, because who am I? Don't hype me up too much. Like, I'm really a regular ass, like, 21-year-old from Alabama. Like, relax. And he's like, no, I don't know who this is. Like, enlighten me. He's like, yeah, no, she's dope. Like, this is like the next big thing, next upcoming thing, like nothing but bars. I you now, would not lie to you, best in the new school. And then he like shakes my hand and is like, thanks for being here. I'm like, yo, thanks for having me. Like, you didn't have to shake my hand. Like, you didn't have to touch me. But that happened. And for hours later, I kind of was just walking around aimlessly and being like, I don't know why I'm here. I had extreme imposter syndrome after that. And I was like, this is crazy. I have to put this on a record. I have to.
So the first kind of big song on the album is called Industry Games. I love the sound of the song. I'm just going to play to refresh, and you might be able to hear a little bit, but like the
play, yeah. Industry games, yeah. Rapping, but they not in love with it. Think it's a shame, yeah. I'm about to pop on some other. Think it's a game. They don't control where I land. Royal flush, get the cards in my hand. I'm trying to stack all these M's. All of my idols is
that sound, it makes me, when I hear it, I think of like, it makes me think of like bells, kind of like da 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 da. What is like the vibe that you were trying to evoke with the song?
I think because it sounded so like sinister and also like very contemplative, I was like, like I have to write to this. And I just kind of, at the time, I just moved out to LA. It was last January, and I was in the house all the time, and I wanted to create, and I felt just like all this energy, and I was like, yo, I just want to talk my shit real quick, like, because I think that like everyone's playing right now. Nobody's really taking it serious. And so I picked a beat that literally sounds like I'm about to go in on somebody. And I clearly did. And that's really what caught me the most.
And what to you is kind of like the epitome of the industry games that you're like describing or talking about like in the song?
I think for me, it's being told to bite my tongue. I guess that's number one. Being told to bite my tongue and to not call BS on a lot of things as someone who like has, I'm A, a woman, B, I'm queer, C, I'm plus size, D, like, I'm an child of immigrants. Like, I have a lot of things stacked up against me, and there's still a lot of, like, respectability politics, and I'm not gonna do that. And also, on top of that, like, I know that sex sells, and, like, I can write songs about sex, like, but I'm not the girl that people would automatically jump to when it comes to women in hip-hop. It's not that it's impossible for a woman to not talk about sex and be successful. It's not that at all. It's more so that the era of rap that I'm existing in, there aren't too many women like me doing what I do without trying to appeal to the male gaze, because I don't care about any of these men. So it's, you know, they've always said be the girl that women want to be and the women that men want to sleep with. And that's not a game that I want to play. I do not care. Like, I can't care. I'm here for the craft. I'm here for the sport of rap and not to appeal or sell a dream to anybody. I'm going to be as real as they come.
Yeah. What's your hope for, like, you know, what's next? Like, what do you hope for kind of like going forward?
The health of our nation. I just wanted everything to go back to normal first and foremost. But after that, I just want to get out there and not just tour, but I'm just really excited for to be able to actually enter this space and compete. Like, I think the competition aspect of rap has kind of died, and we compete via numbers and streams and charting, and like none of that matters to me, because hip-hop is a black art form, and we don't really get the opportunity to uplift it anymore. It's just a trend because it's the number one sound in the world. But like, there was a period of time it was like you could not rap, you did not do it. So I want to kind of get back to that, like, and be a good gatekeeper for what people before me have built.
Pencil. I scribble the stanza as my hands are trembling. Great seven made heaven out of words. I began to build a world that only I inhabit. I got a habit of rapping about tragic. I think I'm just passionate, trying to steer the way.
That's Chica talking with the New Yorker Radio Hour's Gofen and Putubwele. Chica's debut record is called Industry Games.
Young girl, oh,
dream, oh so, oh dear. Plan B, plan well, good luck, no fear. Just waiting, God will tell you when the time's near. But if I never jump, then I die here. Ain't no route till you pick up speed. Ain't think college is all you need. And I don't blame your brainwashing on you, see. It took me 19 years.
I'm David Remnick, and we're going to close the New Yorker Radio Hour today with the actor and comedian Mike Birbiglia. Mike's got some thoughts to share on a subject that's pretty dark, but seems to be on most people's minds lately. Here's Mike Birbiglia.
This is the first time I have spent long stretches imagining my own death. And I feel like I'm okay with some versions of my own death. Like, maybe I go for a nice long walk, I have dinner with my wife and daughter, maybe a phone call with an old college friend, and then a meteor hits the earth. Sign me up for that death. Or maybe this. I take a guitar lesson with Paul Simon, he teaches me The Boxer, and then, for no justifiable reason, I play the song perfectly. Like, better than Simon and Garfunkel in Central Park in 1981. And after I play the final note, Paul looks over at me and says, "That was really good, Mike." And then the building explodes. Obviously, in that scenario, we both die instantly, and then the headline reads, "Paul Simon and unknown comedian die after perfect jam session." There's actually one last death scenario I'd be okay with. To recap, it's dinner with my family and then a meteor. Number two, Simon and Birbiglia followed by explosion. The third and final death scenario I'm okay with is my wife and daughter and I go to the beach. We have a bonfire, which is prepared by bonfire professionals who make sure it's not too hot, but perfect for s'mores. And we make s'mores. Oh, actually, no, wait. That's after we make a bonfire pizza with dough flown in from Frank Pepe's in New Haven. So we do bonfire pizza, then bonfire s'mores, and then my wife leans over to me privately, because our daughter's only five, and she says, "If anything ever happened to you, I want you to know that we would be okay, and that you've given us more than we could hope for in three lifetimes. So God forbid anything happens, we will be fine." And then I say, "I love you both." And I walk into the water, and I'm eaten by a shark. Quickly. The key there actually is quickly. And then the headline reads, "Unknown comedian killed by shark after he kills with thousands of audience members." Those are the ways I'm okay dying. But these days, it's not like that. It's much grimmer. It's hacking coughs and scorching fevers and ventilators and intubations and people sharing their final words with their families through a bad connection on a cell phone. So my only remaining hope in this awful simulation is that if I find myself in a hospital, hooked up to a ventilator that is about to be taken from me, that I will be aided by an adequate amount of medical delirium to actually believe that the last thing I see is Paul Simon, leaning over to say, "Mike, you played that final note perfectly."
Mike Birbiglia. You can read his piece in the Daily Shout section of NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks so much for joining us, and be well.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Danny Bonner, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.